We prayed with Kenneth that we're thankful that Christ always wins, and if we're on His side, we'll win too. Is there a verse in Revelation that captures that idea? 17:14. We're using that as the theme of the letter. These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because He is Lord of lords and King of kings. And those who are with Him are the called and chosen and faithful. We are going to begin in chapter 13, but we had the stage set for it back in chapter 12. In chapter 12, as the movie starts over, time-wise, and we have these two sections to the book of Revelation, two sets to the play, if you want to call it that, starting chapter 4 through chapter 11, and then beginning in chapter 12 again. And what is it at the beginning of chapter 12 that begins to set the stage for our second movie?
The birth of the child.
The birth of the child. Here's this woman that's pregnant, and she's about to give birth, but what's the horrible thing that seems to be that she's going to face? There's a dragon, very ferocious, very powerful, that's ready to consume the child. But she gives birth, and then she's taken away to be protected. The child, what happens to the child? Middle part of the chapter, what happens to the child? He's caught up to God, and what happens? What does it say in verse 10? What does that indicate about the child now? Sitting on the throne, powerful, dominion, he's overcome. Now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of God and the authority of our Christ have come. That is, have been demonstrated by the fact that Satan tried to destroy the child. He was unsuccessful. He tried to destroy the woman. He was unsuccessful. So there's this battle in heaven. He's thrown down to the earth. If he can't destroy the child and he can't destroy the woman, right at the end of chapter 12, we had the stage set for the following chapters. And what is it? What does he try to do now then? He's failed with the woman. He's failed with the child. Woman's children, descendants, right. And who is that? Christians. And so that's what we have in 12:17. The dragon was enraged with the woman and went off to make war with the rest of her children. And then he tells you who they are, who keep the commandments of God and hold to the testimony of Jesus. So you're sitting back watching this play unfold, and that's what you have in chapter 12. So here's this dragon. He's very angry because he's been defeated when he tried to consume the woman, which seems to be God's people viewed as a whole that gave birth to the Messiah, and then they tried to consume the Messiah, and he failed in that. And now he's going to, okay, I'll make war with her seed, Christians. This is where it becomes so down to earth and applicable to the people to whom this letter was written, because they're the ones that is suffering the dragon's wrath now as he tries to capture them. In chapter 13, the dragon is going to wage war with her seed. And so what does he use in the first part of chapter 13? A beast out of what? The sea. Okay, and so we talked about that in our last class. And then, why do people, it says here in verse 3, the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. Verse 8, all who dwell on the earth worship him. Why does it seem like his rule, his following, so almost universal? Why? He's so powerful, you can't resist him. He even looked like he had a fatal wound and recovered from that. And so they fear this beast. And so down in verse 10, which is what the whole letter's talking about from chapter 1 on, we read about it in chapter 1:9, here's the perseverance and the faith of the saints. Even if you have to be led into captivity, are killed with the sword. that you're going to maintain your faith. But there's another beast in the second part of chapter 13. Where does this beast come from?
Out of the earth.
What did I say a while ago? Did I say earth? It was sea. Out of the sea, and this one's out of the earth. All right. And you'll note in verse 11, there's something seemingly contradictory. It doesn't seem to fit. This beast had two horns like a lamb. A lamb. Does that scare you, a lamb? No, that looks kind of peaceful, harmless. But then what's the other deal about the beast? It says in that verse. Spoke like a dragon. So you think, well, this little animal's harmless, but it's not harmless. The very appearance is deceptive. And that's what this beast is about, deceiving people. So he looked like a lamb, got features of a lamb, but he spoke like a dragon. And so he exercised authority of the first beast in his presence. So these two beasts are connected, and both of them are under the rule and dominion and service of the dragon or Satan. And so he makes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast. So his aim is to get the people to worship that first beast whose fatal wound was healed. Well, how is he going to do it? That's what we read about, first of all, in 13 and 14. And we ask you that question. First question we ask, what's the relationship of the second beast to the first beast? Of course, he's trying to make people worship or follow that first beast. What is he going to employ in verse 13 and 14? What? Signs. What's wrong with signs and wonders? Deceiving. He doesn't work signs and wonders. He makes people think he does. He's deceiving. And so he performs great signs, so it even makes the fire come out of heaven to the earth in the presence of men, and he deceives those who dwell on the earth because of the signs which was given him to perform in the presence of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who had the wound of the sword and has come to life. You ever remember reading in a text that's not so symbolical about a warning about people doing signs, deceiving people? Turn over to Matthew 7. What's the warning in verse 15? Beware of false prophets. When you get to 21, he's still talking about prophets. And what do these prophets say they do? Signs. Cast out demons, do many wonderful works in your name. What is the mark of a prophet? He can work miracles, testifying that he's God's prophet. They're deceptive. They're frauds. You've never known anybody today claim to be a prophet of God doing false miracles, have you? Claiming to raise the dead and heal the blind and all that stuff. Well, it was true in the first century. It's true today. It's always been true, and people are deceived by it. And so you see this warning right here in Matthew chapter 7. Interestingly, this second beast that you read about in verse 11 through the end of the chapter, go over to chapter 19, verse 20, just one of two or three other times. What is that second beast called in 19:20? False prophet. You have the beast, and then you have the false prophet who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast, that's the first beast, and had worshipped his image. So he uses deception. Deception's ever been a tool of the devil. When did he start using it? Chapter 3 of Genesis, in the Garden of Eden. It worked then, it's continued to work, he's still using it. And so we see deception being used. Okay, now, in verse 15, what does he appeal to here? And so if you know you're going to be killed, well, what is he appealing to you to worship that beast? What emotion?
Fear.
Fear. So there's deception, there's fear, because it was given to him to give breath to the image of the beast, so that the image of the beast would even speak and cause as many who do not worship the image of the beast to be killed. But then in 16 and 17, there's a third thing. Let me ask you something. Why will people quit going to church, quit studying their Bibles, quit being with their families, and it's okay? What is one thing that always makes it okay?
Work.
You got to work. You got to work. Okay, that's at least people's thinking. Now look here in 16 and 17. He causes all the small and the great, the rich and the poor and the free men and the slaves to be given a mark on their right hand and on their forehead, and provides that no one will be able to buy or to sell except the one who has the mark, either the name of the beast or the number of his name. In other words, you either worship this beast or you're not going to have a job to take care of you and your family. You've got to have the mark of that first beast. You've got the mark indicating you're one of his. You worship him. You follow him. You subscribe to his authority. If not, you may be kicked out of the union. You may be kicked out of the trade guild. How are you going to support your family? What are you going to do? And so they did. When we studied back in the seven letters to the churches, we saw that, for example, in Thyatira. They had trade guilds. I believe it was Thyatira we looked at that. And so this would be a powerful thing. I only mentioned a thing about work because of all things that seems to take a dominance with people. I've got to pay my bills. I've got to take care of my family. So if it means giving up what I believe religiously, so be it. I've got to do this. The devil knows that. And so he uses that second beast to bring this economic hardship upon people. And so Satan uses both of these beasts to his ends. And now you get down to verse 18. Here's wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast. For the number is that, does it say of a certain man? Does it say the man? A man. It's the, in fact, you can just mark the word A out. It's the number of man. What is the, throughout the book of Revelation, we talked about the number 10 indicating completeness, but what's the number that's often associated with divine, deity?
Seven.
And so, if something's wanting to pretend to be seven, but it falls short, what would be a good number?
Six.
And if you want to emphasize that it's human, that it's not of divine origin, what could you do with that number six?
Sixth day.
Huh?
Created on the sixth day.
You repeat it. So you got three sixes. Six, six, six. See? You know, in the Bible, for example, you'll read, verily, verily. Was he stammering? No. It's a way of emphasizing, see? And so he said, it's the number of man, 666. And so, in other words, this is human religion. Look at Colossians chapter 2. We're in a highly symbolical book here in Revelation, but go back to Colossians 2. Here are people who had come out of the world and embraced Christianity, come to believe in the gospel of Christ, but they're still being threatened. And they're being threatened, as you see back in verse 8, through philosophy and empty deception. Well, one of the forms of this is you look in verse 16. No one's to act as your judge in regard to food or drink or respect to a festival or moon or Sabbath day. Where's all that borrowed from?
The law.
The law, Judaism. So whatever he's talking about has some connection with Judaism, but there's more. In verse 18, let no one keep defrauding you of your pride by delighting in self-abasement and the worship of the angels. Taking his stand on what? Visions he has seen. You think he has? But he claims he has. You ever heard anybody talk about they've had a vision from God? God talked to them? And inflated without cause by his flesh and mind, not holding fast to the head. Look at verse 21. Well, let's start 20. If you died with Christ to the elementary principles of the world, why, as though living in the world, do you submit yourself to decrees such as do not handle, do not taste, do not touch? What religion would be teaching the people that in the first century? Ascetic Gnosticism. and it was often intermingled with Judaism. So it had a sense of religion and the worship of God and talked about Jesus Christ. But know what he says in verse 22. He said, in accordance with the commandments and teachings of men. Verse 23. These are matters which have to be sure the appearance of wisdom in what? Self-made religion. And self-made religion is the way this version puts it here in verse 23. And so there's power in that. Is there power in human-derived religion today? Sure, look around you. Look around you. Sure it is. And so if the devil just tells people, oh, there's no God, or there's no use trying to be religious, that's going to turn a lot of people off. But we're going to offer a religion, but it's going to be a human religion with a lot of deception in it. People feel good about it. And that's what you find him using here in this particular case. And so we had suggested in our last class that different people will make these things refer to Rome, and I'm simply suggesting that that's a possibility, but rather maybe to Judaism and its powers. And its we read that all the way through this book, how Judaism was the one that was trying to deceive the people. You're not the real Jews, we are. Judaism was the one that was threatening the people and forcing them to try to change their faith. Just some suggestions as we go through the book. Now, this 666, there's a numerological system used in Jewish mysticism where you take the Hebrew letters, assign them a number, and total them up, and you come up with a name. And so people have played with this for centuries. Some commentators will tell you, here's what this 666 refers to, and they'll take Hebrew letters and they'll come up with Nero. It's not Nero, folks. Let me tell you who it is. I've got an email on my computer. A guy did it and took these numbers and signed these Hebrew letters and assigned numbers to them. It's George Bush. Down through the centuries, it's been done. It's been made to refer to Luther, Benedict the Ninth, Titus, Vespasian, Louis the 15th, Napoleon the First, and a bunch of other names I have here. And to try to make 666 some particular individual in history, that's not the point. It's the deception of human religion that it uses to, he can't kill the woman. She gave birth to the child. He can't keep the child from being enthroned. I'll make war with her seed. I'll use what I used from the very beginning. I'll use deception. I'll use fear. I'll use economic hardship. And it's been working for centuries. He continues to use it in the first century. He's still using it today. That's our adversary. All right, let's look at chapter 14. Yes. Yes, it's not even certain that 666 is actually the right. That's a good point. Yes. There's some question as to whether or not that's the number. All right, chapter 14. Got three sections to chapter 14. We've entitled it on your lesson, Triumph, Warning, and Judgment. You can do it that way. You can do it. The first section is about the 144,000 again. We ran across them in chapter 7. We'll see the difference here. In verse 6 through 13, we have three warnings and three consequences. And then, three warnings, and you have to make three choices. You can choose what you want to do. And then you come down to the last part of the chapter, beginning in 14, you have two harvests, a grain harvest and a grape harvest. So that's the three sections of chapter 14. And as you go through the revelation, there may be things you're not certain about what it means, but at least get the picture that's being painted for you. You're sitting back watching this play or this sound movie. At least see the scene. Don't try to make every detail in it mean something. Just try to get the message that's being presented by all the imagery. All right, so we start here in the first part, in first five verses, and you got the 144,000. Now, he says, I looked and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000. Notice, not 139,999. It's not 144,001. What does that tell you? It's symbolic. It's not an actual number of people. And back in chapter 7, it was made up of 12 tribes. How many was in each tribe? 12,000. Exact number. These are symbolical numbers. Numbers throughout the book, 3, 7, 12, 10, 144,000, of course 12, and then you multiply it by 12, and then you have the 1,000 attached to it. It's just symbolical numbers. Okay. Now, he said about this 144,000, they're having his name and the name of the Father on their foreheads. I asked you a question. Contrast the 144,000 with those in 13, 16, and 17. What's the difference in these people and those people? Who they belong to is a good answer. How do you know who they belong to? Because of the mark, because of the seal. In 13, 16, and 17, they're given a mark on their right hand or their forehead. That is, they belong to the beast. The second beast tries to get them to get that mark. Say, you belong to him. It's a mark of ownership, a seal that you follow him. But here, these people also have a mark, but it's not the mark of the beast. They have a seal. And on their name, on their foreheads is the name of the Lamb and the name of the Father written on their foreheads. Literally? Obviously not. It's, again, the picture. See the picture. Ownership. These people belong to God and to the Lamb. Okay, so also in chapter 7, 1 through 8, when we studied the 144,000, where were they? Go back to chapter 7. Start, where does it start? This, they're going to bring this harm, and they're told to hold back the four winds. Where are these people at? On the earth. Where are the 144,000 in chapter 14? Verse 3. Before the throne. One of the markings we suggested throughout the book are the geological markings. If you save one color for that all through the book, you mark that immediately you see that. Oh, those back there, the 144,000, were on the earth. And there has to be some protection given to them so that they're not harmed with this destruction. But now the 144,000 are before the throne. So you see the change there. Now they're victorious. They're triumphant. That's one reason we put one way to outline the chapter's triumph. This is a picture of triumph. This is a picture of victory, these 144,000. And I heard a voice from heaven like a sound of many waters and like the sound of loud thunder. And the voice which I heard was like the sound of harpists playing on their harps. So there, you got instrumental music in heaven, right? Is that what this proves?
No.
No, why not? It says they got harpers harping on the harp. Do you believe the Bible means what it says or not?
Metaphor and figurative.
Figurative, right. Is there thunder in heaven too? Loud thunder? And so it's imagery, and people will use this to try to justify instrumental music and worship here on earth today. But it's not. There's nothing. Is there anything material in heaven? No.
It doesn't.
You're right. It says like, doesn't it? Doesn't even say they have harps. It said like, which is a simile of figure speech. Okay, so a good point that Wally makes. And so they sang a new song before the throne and before the four living creatures and the elders, and no one could learn the song except the 144,000. Now we wonder, who are these people? So let's look who they are. We already talked about that back in chapter 7 when we talked about that 144,000 and discussed in that chapter who they were, people had washed their robes in the blood of the Lamb. And here we are in chapter 14. Let's see if we come up with the same kind of conclusion. There are four things said about them here in verses 4 and 5. What's the first thing said about them?
They're chaste.
They're chaste. They've kept themselves chaste. Now, if this is talking about physical immorality, he says they've not been defiled with women and kept themselves chaste. If that's talking about physical immorality, yeah, the question arises, why did you single that one act of immorality out? So let's hold that for a moment. Then he says, and by the way, note in verse 4, he's definitely intending to identify them. Note these phrases, these are the ones, these are the ones, these. And so he definitely, for the reader, intending to identify who are these people, these 144,000. Here's who they are. They've kept themselves chaste. What's the second thing? Follow the Lamb wherever he goes. What would be one word to describe them?
Faithful.
Devout. Devout. Saints. No, Christians. Thank you. You read my mind, Ennis. But all those other words are just as good. They're good. But they follow the Lamb. They follow the Lamb. They have faith in Christ, and that's where their hope is. But saints, faithful, devoted, all of that's good. And so he said, what's the third thing? No, the third thing. Purchased as first fruits to God and to the Lamb. They've been purchased. And so you see that back in verse 3 also. They've been purchased from the earth. And now he says purchased from among men. So here's the world of men, but here's some that have been purchased. What have they been purchased by? Read that in earlier chapters. What paid the price for their redemption? The blood of the Lamb. They've been purchased. Okay, so we know number 2 and number 3 is talking about Christians, or devout, faithful Christians. Now we come to number 4. And no lie was found in their mouth. They are blameless. Again, that could be talking about the specific sin of lying, but why single it out? So what I suggest to you is that number 1 and 4 fall like the other two, and they're talking about spiritually pure and devoted and faithful Christians. That is, they're chaste. Remember back in 2 Corinthians 11:2, Paul talked about the church at Corinth, and he said, I've presented you as a chaste virgin. As a chaste virgin. In Ephesians chapter 5, in the imagery of a bride, Christ died that the church might be washed and that it might be pure, and a picture of a wife. And so the deal about a lie in 1 John 2, those of you who were in our 1 John class, 1 John 2:22, who's a liar but he who denies that Jesus is the Christ? No lies in their mouth. What is the beast trying to get them to do? Deny Christ. There's no lie in their mouth. They will not adopt that to avoid. They have not adopted it, although they're now triumphant. That's why they're triumphant. They have not adopted that out of fear or deception or economic hardship. In John 10:4, Jesus says, I know my own, and they follow me. And that's what you have here. It says they follow the Lamb. James 1:18 talks about Christians being first fruits to God. And then throughout the Revelation, we have this similar type of imagery of purity and devotion to God. So this is a picture of Christians, if I understand it. So the 144,000 are who? They're Christians, triumphant Christians, people who have been faithful to their Lord in the face of every difficulty. And now they sing around the throne as they rejoice in the glory of Almighty God. And this is the assurance of this book. You follow the Lamb, as Kenneth said in his prayer, you're going to win. You don't follow the Lamb, you're going to lose. We're in a war. It's an everyday war. And whether you win or not depends on who you follow and who you put your trust in, who you fear. And that needs to be the God of heaven. Okay. Now we have three warnings in verse 6 through 13. You have an angel in 6. You have another angel in 8, a second one, and a third angel in 9. So you got three angels. And they're issuing warnings. And so the first angel in six and seven, what is his warning there in verse 7? All right, judgment's coming. Worship God. He says, fear God. Fear God and give Him glory. Because, here's why you need to fear Him. The hour of His judgment has come. If you've been marking the coming phrases throughout the book, is this the second coming? No. No, it's not second coming. This is not the judgment at the end of time. This is the judgment on those who will not repent, who are not serving God, and they're going to suffer the punishment, whether it's Jerusalem or Rome. But that's the idea. The hour of his judgment has come. Worship him who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the springs and the waters. So that's the warning of the first angel. What's the second angel warning about? Babylon has fallen. If you're putting your faith in Babylon, you've been deceived by this harlot. Babylon is called the great city. Notice here it just says the great. But it's called the great city in other texts that we will look at. And back in chapter 11 and 8, the great city, what is it back there? You know what it is back there. What is it? Jerusalem. So, at least some will make this wrong, and maybe it is, but I'm just suggesting to you, he's called Jerusalem very clearly the great city in 11 and 8. And so, if you're putting your faith in Jerusalem, was there anybody back then to put their faith in Jerusalem?
Yes.
Sure. The people you've been dealing with all through the book. The Jews put their faith in Jerusalem. I think that's what Peter was talking about in Acts 2. When he talked about he used these catastrophic terms of judgment about the astronomy, that your city is going to fall. Quit putting your trust in it. Let me tell you who the Lord is. But nevertheless, they put their confidence in Jerusalem. And he said, look, it's going down, folks. Babylon has fallen. Who made the nation drink of the wine of the passion of immorality? And then what's the third warning? In verse 9 through 11, can you summarize that? What happens if you make the wrong choice in verse 9 through 11? You suffer the wrath of God. These are pictures of divine punishment. So here's the warning. This angel is flying about, verse 6, and he says, fear God, the hour of judgment has come. Second angel says, look, Babylon has fallen. The one that you may have made an alliance with, she's going down. Third warning, you make the wrong choice, you suffer the divine wrath of God in this picture of divine judgment. Don't make the wrong choice. You've got three angels warning people with these warnings of judgment. Now, note in verse 12 and 13, in contrast to these warnings, there's a word of comfort given to the saints. He says, verse 12, here's the perseverance of the saints who keep the commandments of God and their faith in Jesus. So they will not succumb to the beast. They will not be entangled with the woman. They keep their purity. They maintain their faith. What comfort does he give them in verse 13? Blessed why? They rest from their labor, for their deeds follow with them. Remember Jesus said early in the book, I know your deeds. I know your deeds. He said, I know your poverty. He said, I know where you live, where Satan dwells. I know everything about you. You be faithful till death, and I'll give you the crown of life. Here are people who maintained their faith to the very end. As soon as they took their last breath, everything changed. Lazarus was no more suffering the sores and torment and the shame of the dog licking his sores. He was in a place of peace. The rich man who was living a life of ease, he was in a place of torment. Things changed like that. Serve Christ to the end, you'll be blessed. If you die in the Lord. And in the Lord doesn't just mean I was baptized. It means you're faithful to that commitment. In the face of every trial and every deception and every effort of Satan to lead you away. And so the Lord knows your struggles. He knows your trials. And those who die in the Lord will rest from their labors. No more battle. No more of this thing that you've got to put up with. It's all over with. Now you rejoice. All right. So three warnings. You make a choice. Three consequences mentioned if you in that particular section. Okay. Now, the end of the chapter, there are harvests of judgment. The fact that there's two different harvests is indicated in the terminology. You'll note that, behold, a white cloud, and sitting on the cloud was one like a son of man, having a golden crown on his head and a sharp sickle in his hand. A sickle was used to gather either the grain or the grape clusters. But that is grain in the first harvest is indicated when he says, another angel came out of the temple crying out with a loud voice to him who sat on the cloud, put in your sickle and reap, for the hour to reap has come, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. If you have the New American Standard Version, on the word ripe, there's a little number beside it, on is ripe. What does it say out in the margin? What literally did John write? Has become dry, right? Become dry. That's not grapes. That's grain. Grain, ready for harvest. It's a different word, ripe, in verse 18 in the text, actually. So you got a grain harvest that's ready for the sickle to reap the harvest. And so that was reaped, verse 16. Then in verse 17, you have another harvest. And so you have another angel. He also has a sickle. And so verse 18, another angel had power of a fire, came out of the altar. And he called with a loud voice to him, had the sharp sickle, saying, put in your sharp sickle and gather the clusters from the vine of the earth, because her grains are ripe. How do you know this second judgment is one of judgment? The second harvest is one of judgment. How do you know? Verse 19. The angel swung the sickle to the earth and gathered the clusters from the vine of the earth and threw them into the great wine press of the wrath of God. The wine press was trodden outside the city, and blood came out of the wine press up to the horses' bridles for a distance of 200 miles. Obviously figurative language, but it's an indication of a great, great judgment. And so you have two harvests. You have a harvest of grain, you have a harvest of grapes. The harvest of grapes is clearly associated with the judgment of God, the wrath of God. All the way through this book, there's been a contrast made, hasn't there? Between those righteous and those who are not righteous, between those who trust in the Lamb and those who do not, and how those who trust in the Lamb will be victorious and the others will not. In verse 15, he said, the hour to reap has come. Did that talk about the end of time? No. This coming, all the way through the book, from chapter 1, all the way to the very end of the book, chapter 22:7. I am coming, what? Quickly. 22:12, I'm coming quickly. And this is a judgment. And so here are these people who are suffering, but God's going to bring judgment upon their oppressors. And so, and they're going to be enjoy, it's actually going to be gospel for them. Look in verse 6, by the way. This first angel, it says he's preaching the eternal gospel. But verse 7, he's preaching judgment. How can it be good news if it's judgment? Because it's judgment on their enemies. That's good news. See? It's gospel, but it's judgment on their enemies. Yes, it's right for Christians to expect to be avenged. You see that in this book. And so, back in... We'll not turn there for now. You'll have to rely on your memory. But back in Matthew 3, Jesus used an imagery of a harvest, and you have grain, and you have wheat, and you have chaff. The wheat, what's done with it? Taken into the barn. The chaff, what happens to it? Burned up. That's right. And in that text, he said to the people he's talking to, the axe is already laid to the root of the tree. Who's he talking to? Jew. What Jew particularly? The leaders. Your nation, in whom you trust, is going to be cut down, and it's not going to be very long. And so the axe is already laid to the root of the trees. In Matthew 21, you can write these down and go read them. I'm going to cover 15 if I do it in 2 minutes, but I'm going to cover chapter 15. So you can read Matthew chapter 21, write down verse 19, and then go down to verse 43. And you'll see again the imagery of a tree not bearing fruit, and it's going to be cut down. And it's clearly, they understood, they're talking about us, about the Jewish leaders, their nation. Matthew 21, 19, 43. Another one is Luke chapter 13, verse 3. Except you repent, you'll perish. And we usually make that kind of general, but when you go down to verse 6, again, you have this imagery of a tree not bearing fruit. Okay. I've got 3 minutes to cover 15. We're going to do it. 15 prepares the way for 16. Look at chapter 16, verse 1. I heard a loud voice from the temple saying to the seven angels, go and pour out on the earth the seven bowls of the wrath of God. Where did that come from? 15. You have seven angels with seven bowls of wrath. Okay, so look back at 15:1. I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous. Seven angels who had seven plagues. And down in verse 7, he calls them seven bowls of wrath. And I ask you that question, what are the seven bowls of wrath called? Verse 1, they're called seven plagues. In other words, they're judgment under various imageries. And when you do chapter 16, if you study chapter 16, go back and compare the judgments back in the seven angels previously in the book. You'll find it very interesting, the parallel in each one of these judgments. But nevertheless, he said, note verse 1, very interesting statement. In them the wrath of God is what? Finished. Remember that statement back in 10:7 that I mentioned was a very key statement? Look in 10:7. When the seventh angel sounded, what did he say? Mystery of God is finished. It's finished. As he preached to his servants, the prophets. This mystery that was preached to his servants, the prophets, will reach its culmination, be finished. You'll see at the end of the chapter 15, the seven plagues of the seven angels were finished. And so remember that as you go through this and tie those verses together. And so these seven angels are going to pour out these bowls of wrath. So verse 2, I saw something like a sea of glass mixed with fire, and those who had been victorious. If you've been marking the overcoming words, this would be one of them. It doesn't say overcoming, but it's the same word. These are the overcomers, if you want to put it that way. These are the overcomers. All the way from chapter 2, you've been talking about to him who overcomes. Overcome, overcome, overcome. Can you? Yes. Yes, you can. And here are overcomers. And they overcame the beast, that terrible beast with all of his ferocious power. Efforts to deceive. They overcame the beast and his image and the number of his name. They're standing on the sea of glass holding harps of God. They sang the song of Moses and the bondservant of God, the song of the Lamb sang. The song of Moses, when was that sung? When they came out of Exodus. Were they facing a beast? Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Egypt was a beast wanting to devour the people of God, but they failed. And when they came out of Egypt victorious, they sang the song of Moses and the Lamb, song of victory. God defeated their enemies. And here these people are singing the song of victory before the presence of God. Great and marvelous are your works. Righteous and true are your ways. What ways? Look at verse 4. For your righteous acts have been revealed. That is, his acts and ways of judgment upon their enemies. And they're praising God for that. And so after these things, I'm not finished yet. So anyway, after these things I look, the tabernacle was open, and you have these seven angels, and we'll start in chapter 16. As these angels began to pour out these seven plagues, the Lord willing, next Sunday morning, I won't be here Wednesday night, next Sunday morning, we'll begin in chapter 16. Okay?